We live in a world in which many of us spend much of our time feeling dulled, stultified, numb. Much of what we do is compulsory or routine. It stems from the things that we like least about ourselves, and often we feel weak. We wait and wait for the end of our shift, for when we can go to bed and end the day, for the weekend or the vacation, for the fix from the bottle, the sugar, or the Netflix. The hum of electronics, the drivel of advertisements and news, and sometimes even the tiresome small talk among those we call our friends, coalesce into a drone that, at times, seems to drown out any other possibility. We are told we've arrived, the end of history, the land of the free, the best of all possible worlds. But some of us feel, deeply and undeniably, that a different life is possible. We know this possibility in our flesh, for we have felt moments of ecstasy, joy, and freedom that are burnt so indelibly into our consciousness as to preclude any doubt. We call these moments, and the people who have felt them, the brilliant, because they are glorious to feel and yet dangerous to know, for they beckon us to a life way of passion that is not easily slaked by a world that rewards torpor. The Brilliant Podcast is an effort to share those moments and to foster them, to tell stories and explore ideas in a way that stokes our passions and reminds us that a world of ecstasy and mystery lies buried, but alive, beneath the malaise and drudge that tries daily to convince us that it is all that is, has ever been, or could be. I am your host Bellamy, joined by co-host Aragorn, and in the background, our sound engineer is Roy Burton.
And for your information, this is episode 16 of the Brilliant Podcast.
This is episode 16 of the Brilliant. And we are sad to say that the two episodes that we had lost, where we talked about bioregionalism, really are lost and gone forever into the void. And so we might take that topic up again in a month or two, but not for a bit.
Nothing fresh to say. And it looks like this episode we're going to talk quite a bit about some listener feedback. We're going to engage a little bit with a different podcast. And then we're going to talk about society.
More about society, yes.
More. Always society.
It still exists. It will exist as long as it exists, we can keep talking to you through the internet, though.
Yeah, that's true. On the plus side, this podcast would not be possible without society. On the downside, society.
So should we start with...
Yeah, let's start with this.
So, I just had occasion the other day to listen to an older episode of Anarchy Radio. This was from December 1st. And filling in for John Zerzan, who was out of town, were Ian Smith, who does the Uncivilized Animals blog, and Jariah Bowser, who also blogs and I think writes articles, and is both of them are influenced by and orbiting around anarcho-primitivism, which makes sense. Why they filled in for John. And so Jariah ended up following up on uncharitable comments that John Zerzan has directed in my direction, which was nice, although I was hurt by the fact that he called me Blammy.
Well, vowels are fucked up.
Yes. Yeah. And so they, mostly Jariah was talking about the intersections among anarcho-primitivism, egoism, and nihilism, which has become a thing that people talk about, I think, mostly because John Zerzan talks about it a lot. And I wanted to talk to you about some of the ways that Jariah was characterizing nihilism, the way he was talking about it. Do you have responses, reactions?
Well, I think that I really, really regret my contribution to this thing that we're calling nihilism. And it's exemplified by his description. in this way where, and you know, John is obviously mostly responsible for this, not Jiraiya, but this idea that there are these different camps and these different sort of belief systems and perhaps big men at the center of each of these belief systems. And so the choice that you're presented with as a consumer of ideology is to pick which of the terminologies you like best and perhaps which of the charismatic big men you like best. And so I really regret that. And I hate the fact that all of these ideas lean in the direction of sort of allowing this to happen. And I know that, you know, egoism especially, like, really tries to befuddle this set of expectations. And yet, there's something about the American mind, the Western mind, the modern society that really encourages, especially, you know, younger men to think about these systems of thinking and to sort of tease out these systems, and the way to really figure them out is to play them off of each other and perhaps to put their body in the mix, but most of the time to act as if one is of distance from these ideas and yet is willing to argue them and argue these points. And so in this conversation, you know, I've uncharitably described Ian in the past in another podcast as sort of the nice guy primitivist. And
the reasonable man.
Right, the reasonable one. And you actually saw in Jiraiya wasn't actually allowed to articulate a clear and complete thought without Ian basically being reasonable but absolutely sectarian as an anarcho-primitivist against someone who was sort of saying, I'm somewhere between primitivism, egoism, and nihilism. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of my first impression of that conversation, was just this idea of, like, one of the best ways to sort of defeat your ideological opponents is to never allow them a complete thought. And this is actually one of the few places where I'm going to mention Chomsky charitably. You know, Manufacturing Dissent, if you've never read it, it's a very important book. Consent. It's an important book that basically talks about the fact that you can't fucking talk about a deep or complete idea in a less than 5-minute soundbite. So it would be, you know, what Jiraiya was attempting to do in the context of this podcast was just talk about these ideas fairly in a context where John usually is absolutely unfair. What would have been nice would have been to hear a little bit more about how these ideas actually settle into Jiraiya's body and how Jiraiya actually reflects these values as their own, rather than just doing sort of a Cliff Notes version.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a very, I think, an unfortunate phenomenon maybe of the podcast medium, that because it's weekly, because it's short, because as someone who does podcasting, you often do feel the press of time, and so you do end up with these canned rebuttals and canned dismissals and canned definitions. And it was actually through the process of doing a podcast and having people interacting with me and responding that I ended up sort of taking on a brand, basically, because these ideas that I found interesting, I felt like kept being chronically misrepresented and dismissed. And so gradually I kept saying, well, wait, that's not really how it is. This is another way of looking at it. And then before I know it, I have been hedged somewhat non-consciously into articulating a brand.
Mm-hmm. But I think you wanted to talk about the content of what Jiraiya had to say.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, part of what I was drawing your attention to was that he actually drew a parallel between his perception of nihilism and the primal war of anarcho-primitivism, mm-hmm. and I pointed that out to you as something that I thought would be surprising, to say the least.
It's not surprising. Uh-huh. I mean, first of all, the connection between a green perspective and nihilism makes perfect sense for people to have embraced, because the first article on this topic, Nihilism as Strategy, was written for GA Magazine. Mm-hmm. So it was always the goal to for there to be a parallel drawn there. And as far as the Primal War thing, I mean, perhaps I'm being rude by saying this, but I've never taken the term Primal War seriously. To me, it's always been a sort of joke. Like when you're talking about a band, you know, you might, like, make a joke about the fact that, oh, here comes the mosh part. And so in the context of anarcho-primitivism, the idea that there's actually a fully fleshed theoretical concept of primal war, that's the, perhaps the transitional program between the shit show we live in now and the post-apocalyptic anarcho-primitivism utopia, I don't think anyone really argues that. It just looks good on a t-shirt.
Well, I always thought of it as this weird kind of reskinning of the Hegelian dialectic. And so it's not the contradiction in classes that drives history and is going to resolve things. The contradiction between nature and civilization is the process of history, and it's going to resolve itself at some point.
Well, while you sound more nice when you say it, that's actually a more cruel way.
Oh, I'm totally aware that it's a more cruel way of talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just see it as kind of a joke and am willing to laugh, and you're basically fucking tarring it with a Hegel brush.
Well, okay. So one way that I heard Jiraiya talking about this, I'm rephrasing things, but is that nihilism is almost this sort of natural animal condition, where it's the animality, where you remove this very civilized conceptual thinking of linear time and this idea that you have to justify your beliefs or emotions through abstract values, and instead it's you're going back to this sort of primality and immediacy. Do you think that's a fair take on how you use it?
No, but I think that's almost irrelevant. Like that's actually, from my perspective, that's a very generous reading of nihilism and sort of a nice idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm trying not to fucking say mm-hmm anymore because it sounds terrible in the podcast, but I can't stop doing it.
Yeah, I think that it's best to say words with open mouths. Like, yes, okay.
But even that, I don't want to...
Go ahead. I hear you. I guess what a lot of people tend to do as soon as the term nihilism comes up is they become nihilist maximalists, where they basically talk about, like, okay, you've presented this very challenging idea, this idea that perhaps the value systems that we are encumbered with right now, that we could shed them. If we shed them, in my opinion, it could look like this. And to me, I want people to engage in that sort of experimentation, but I don't necessarily want them to do it in the name of Sartre or in the name of Dostoevsky or in the name of anything that came before, because shedding all of the assumptions that we have about how society operates, that's an enormous project. That will take you a decade of your life, is to really dig into and understand all this machination. So for me, the last thing I want to do is encumber that freeing with yet another encumbrance, you know,
with the history of philosophy or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And especially the sort of like the dark current of philosophy, like, you know, and so
shadowy European men.
Exactly. And blue glasses and
in their
black
portraits,
hats.
They're wearing dark colors.
And so I've always kept a very minimalist definition of nihilism insofar as I think nihilism is relevant to an anarchist thought. And you know, so at some point I've stopped calling it nihilism and just call it anarchism, and am willing to point to certain points or talk about specifics. So my minimalist definition of nihilism in this context is just the lack of belief in revolution.
Yeah, that's very minimal.
It's very minimal. And this is just so that we can keep the conversation going and not get so bogged down in the nihilism part. But for me, there are a lot of tendencies that also agree that revolution is not possible. And so it is true that I'm attempting to draw much more on, you know, the ought and tot sort of family of values. When I do that, when I make that statement, but there's lots of, like, Hawking Bay and Taz and sort of all the, like, peace and love neo hippies that have expressed anarchism over the past 30 years. Those people also believe that revolution is not possible. They just play it more positively.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in that sense, you know, when I say the revolution is impossible, you know, what I mean isn't that there couldn't be a changing of the guard or a palace coup, But is that a palace coup is basically the extent of which I see human imagination actually expressing itself when it comes to social change in the current time period. And people can disagree with me, but I mostly think that they're crazy. Like, that even if you take the most positive spin of the kind of action that we've seen in my lifetime, you know, and even prior to my lifetime in the late 60s, you know, the imagination at the most revolutionary moment in the past 50 years, that imagination was limited to getting out of Vietnam. I'm sorry, that's right. Not the same thing as the kind of revolution that anarchists of all stripes more or less are arguing for. It's a fraction.
So to be fair to your critics, what you're describing here is very specific and explicit with the refusal of revolution as a possible way out. Mm. Often the way I've heard you put it, and I think what rankles people, is the refusal of hope, which sure. sounds different to people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about hope, as you talked about it a few episodes ago, you were saying it's a way of representing yourself to yourself rather than just being present with the action. And so do you think the refusal of hope is broader than the mere denial of revolution as a way out? Or are you just being equivocal when you talk about it that way?
I would actually say that I see it as saying the same thing in different words.
Okay.
So,
but I think a lot of people
would
say, true. I have hope, but I don't believe in revolution.
Maybe. I mean, I don't... in my taxonomy, for political radicals, right? So we are political radicals because we have a desire for a different world.
Sure.
And that desire is because... We all put it in different ways, but... You know, we live in this desert, and we find ourselves in an oasis where we drink from the same pool, and that pool is what I would call hope.
Okay,
but perhaps it's a mirage. Perhaps it isn't actually there, and we just happen to find ourselves, you know, where the only tree around was, and so I guess what I'm getting at is. I really do feel like it's a different way of saying the same thing, which is
you lost me a bit with the metaphor there, because I thought there could be some of us who said it is a mirage or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you may take the metaphor and do with it what you will, but I guess what I'm getting at is the thing that we call a desire for revolution comes from drinking from that pool. In other words, we find each other and we think, well, if we share these values, if we share this desire to transform the world, how do we talk about that desire with other people, with new people who didn't go through the same process that we went through to be talking about transforming the world? And this is where sort of it gets encumbered by this political language like revolution. But the originary moment for, I think, most of us is that sort of like, feeling like the world is a desert, finding some sort of spot where we can look in other people's eyes and feel like we're talking about the same types of topics, and then trying to find a shared language to talk about what to do with this information and these values that we share. And so that's the only way, and like it's somewhat of a mistake to go there and to sort of talk about hope in that sort of a context, because... For me, I absolutely see it as a sort of spectacular phenomena, and so in this way, also, like I prefer spectacular language rather than egoist language, but I the parallels are clear.
Uh-huh. And when you say spectacular language, you mean saying things like "I reject hope," or what do you mean?
No, I mean I'm specifically referring to the situationist critique of society,
okay,
and of
sure.
this thing called the spectacle.
Sure, sure, sure.
And so for me, it's really important to talk about the mirrored way in which people sort of get lost, And that's actually part of the hope thing. Like, hope is sort of like a spiritual affect of talking about someone lost in the maze of spectacular reality. But most of the time when people talk about spectacular reality, they're just talking about media. Mm-hmm. They're not talking about the sort of mirrored effect that people do where they strap a Hegel onto everything that they talk about,
yeah,
and therefore get lost in this reflection.
Conceptual spectacularism.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so then, excuse me, Jirai and Ian moved on to talking about egoism. And I initially had a bit of hope myself in the idea that someone on Anarchy Radio was actually going to talk about this in a way that I liked. That wasn't me appearing on John's show. And Jirai was talking about desiring a world in what is good for me is good for you, and not having this kind of zero-sum satisfaction of desires or zero-sum happiness, and instead identifying other people as being part of yourself. And I think that's mostly a way that I would agree with, but he killed me. He brought me in, and then he clubbed me when he said egoism, of course, presupposes an ego, which is something that I feel like I've tried to talk to death is not really the case. And this makes me very confident that I, in most cases, I'm not being heard, and I might as well continue to peel my skin off and realize that no one's going to talk about this in the way that I want, except for a very small number of people.
Or perhaps you.
Perhaps me. But see, this is, again, the being backed into defending the brand, mm-hmm, which just drives me fucking nuts and makes me feel like I'm being boring.
How would you respond to that in the moment?
The presupposing an ego thing? Mm-hmm. I think it's very clear and comes up multiple times in The Unique and Its Property that the idea is to reject the Cartesian sense of self. The idea is to reject the subject-object dichotomy and realize that your sense of identity is not contained merely within your body and is not this narcissistic representation of yourself to yourself.
Sorry. What's an example of how one would do that?
So embracing an extended self that recognizes that there's a self of community. There's a self that is composed of intimate relationships with others.
Sorry, is that an example?
That is an example, yes. That,
I guess by example, I mean, can you paint a picture? Because, mm-hmm, because what you're doing is sort of using a Cartesian logic to create an example. What I'm looking for, and I think what most people are looking for, is how can I visualize...
We're going to get into the Dunbar's number a bit. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so, to me, an example of realizing these values would be...
What I would call an example.
Something that you would call an example. Would be existing in a world that is composed of face-to-face intimate relationships. And
so the egoist project cannot exist as long as there's a thing called society. Or it has to exist...
Only as a refusal of it, yeah. Uh-huh. And I think, yeah, as so long as we... And this was sort of my attempt at a transition... So long as we have mass society, we're going to exist in a world of abstractions all the time, abstract people. And that as much as it would be nice to... And obviously people have taken it this way.
Let's give a shout out to Jiraiya. This is what he was attempting to do in his synthesis. Mm-hmm. He was exactly trying to make this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, this is where I see the intersections that, yeah, he's getting at. Is that even though it would be nice, I think, and certainly some individualists would say, I can realize the egoist project by just existing as this hyper-iconoclastic person even in society, I think the only way this kind of union of egoists could be realized would be in a world without mass society, a world that is about intimate face-to-face community. Hmm. And intimacy with one's land base. And I think that would actually be the realization of a world that is maybe not entirely without Geist, but is approaching that, or is at least far closer than this world.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, mostly because generationally it is a break from the egoists that have come before, because I do think in general the egoists who have come before have more or less made the argument that they are
realizing it,
wandering vagabonds. Mm-hmm. That they are to some extent living an impossible philosophical perspective in their bodies, in the here and now, in this world. And what you're basically saying is that you cannot begin until you leave mass society.
I think maybe... My generous take on what those people would be doing is recognizing or maybe sort of conceding that they're never going to see the world that they would want, and so this is the closest that you can get, is to be this wandering iconoclastic person who tries to refuse as many social values as possible, refuse engaging in socially conventional behavior as much as possible, and so the rejection is just the kind of constant struggle against that.
Okay, that's great. Should we move on?
Sure. Do you want to...
Oh, yeah, we're going to do some listener feedback.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, we've received at least two provocative emails. Is there anything else you want to talk about other than these two things?
I don't think so.
Because they're a little bit more pointed at me.
Yeah.
But we'll bounce it right back to you as soon as we express it. Okay. So the first email, and I'll just read what it says here. I'm wondering about Aragorn's idea of taking on projects that are human-sized. My perception of this framing is that it's inadequate at best and encouraging a kind of patheticness at worst. You speak of work on projects that you know you can accomplish in order to not feel exacerbated by such a project as positioning yourself against the state. So I guess the context that statement came out of was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I'm trying to use this podcast as a way to not talk about critique all the time, because I feel like I am becoming grumpier as I get older, and I'm not appreciating the kind of pressure that I feel like, oh, well, how about this idea? This idea seems like a good idea, and sort of being asked to sort of like critique people's hard work or something, and I don't like that. I don't like the way in which I put myself into that position, and I also don't like how easy it is. And so what I was trying to accomplish by talking about projects and talking about projects in general is to say something that feels positive, that feels accomplishable, that feels worth doing. And I mention that because I do not walk up to people on the street or people who are new to anarchism and say, you should do a project and you should make sure it's something you can actually accomplish. That said, when I refer to a project as being accomplishable, I'm not referring to it being like, you know, making dinner is an achievable goal. And then, you know, an hour later or 2 hours later, you look back and say, I achieved that goal. Look at me. And if I just continue to achieve goals like this, we could win. When I think of an achievable goal, I think of a goal that may or may not be possible, but the forces aligning against you, you're not falling into a sort of... a patterned role. So when I refer to a lot of anarchist goals as being sort of overturning, like they're conceived of as being overturning the state, that's a type of way of thinking about a problem that's very solvable by the people that you're against. So for instance, if you think that abolishing the state looks like running in the halls of the Oakland City Hall and turning over some flags and maybe breaking a few windows, like the systems are fully in place to rationalize every aspect of that type of action. So I have found myself doing a lot of media projects as the kind of projects that I take on, and part of why they're accomplishable is because, of course, you can see an end result, you can see a product. And why that's a positive thing is because it's almost impossible to see the product of overturning the state or of, you know, abolishing mass society. So in the context of that comment, I really was just trying to talk about an orientation of anarchist projects towards futility and towards failure, and was really just trying to talk about the idea of, like, if we think it through and if we think about what we actually want through, perhaps we can work on projects that don't fail as they begin. So as much as I would not myself be interested in projects like throwing seed bombs over fences and community gardens and all the rest, that's really a matter of aesthetics. The fact that I don't find those things to be aesthetically attractive for me to work on, rather than that I disagree with them as projects that I feel like do accomplish the task of being doable.
And so really what this message is about is one that we've been grappling with. We spent some time talking about it with the last time when we responded to all the criticism, that the idea is if you don't dream big and you don't aim big, mm-hmm. then anarchists are doomed to perpetually be bit players on the stage of the world. And so I think the way someone might reply is to say, okay, sure, Aragorn, I can see how these media projects or these gardens are doable, and maybe they quote-unquote build power in the way that you talked about, but what if the next generation, that's all they do, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, and so people have this perception of building power, but really they are guaranteeing that they will always be minimal.
Yeah, what's funny about that analysis is that I absolutely don't feel like anyone around me ever has a conversation that sounds like we're building power, we're learning from the mistakes in the past, and all the rest, right? Mostly the experience that I have is of people passing through in very rapid rotation, through anarchism, through any set of doing anything with these ideas, that most people who call themselves anarchists over time live quiet little lives, right? As actually exemplified by the person who was just by last night. Their life was small. They weren't talking about destroying everything. And that for me over time, as I have built on what I've been doing for a few decades, I'm finding that I can be more audacious. So, for instance, we're talking about doing a new media project, and it is the most audacious media project that I've yet sort of conceptualized.
And the aim is quite large,
right? And so that's a little bit more of what I'm referring to. For me, the goal isn't to do tasks that are necessarily going to end in success, but is to do tasks that it is possible for them to end in success. Whereas, you know, as much as I love my friends who fight on the streets, they have set themselves upon a task that mostly can never succeed, other than by smashing glass. Like, in other words, if they express their goals as being, let's go out on a Saturday night and break some windows, that's an achievable task. But if they say, let's go smash the state, and they think that turning to the street and smashing glass is somehow connected to that goal, that audacious goal, I think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the next, I'm not sure, maybe there isn't a question in here, but
we had someone write and respond who, this is a person whose anarchist analysis was very much motivated by an anthropological perspective.
Right. And basically, the question that they ask is sort of a very precise sort of question, so it's easy to talk about in that way. But so Vine Deloria, who is a personal, like, a preference of mine. I really like Vine Deloria and his writing.
And maybe just mention, this is an American Indian academic, I think it'd be fair to say.
Yeah, he was a lifelong academic, and he wrote the books that people know him best for is Custer Died for Your Sins, and which is basically sort of calibrates a lot of our modern understanding of what the condition of Native Americans are, specifically insofar as anthropologists have been partial creators of that, of the condition of natives today, and also the book God is Red, which is about to sort of secularize native spirituality. But it's a very nice spiritual book. Anyways, do you know how to pronounce that name? Velikovsky?
I would think it would be Velikovsky, but I don't know.
So, basically the questioner asks this question about Vine and Velikovsky. So, a group of scholars for some time have been interested for different reasons in this question of human origin and sort of what does human origin look like. In the case of Velikovsky, I'm just going to read this here. He supports Velikovsky. This is Vine Deloria supports Velikovsky in God is Red, who has some really outrageous thoughts. For instance, they try to say that if we look at all sorts of indigenous cultures across the world, there are myths about floods or major disasters or whatever, and the cause of those shared myths is a result of events in our universe. Things like Mars almost crashing into Earth or Jupiter going out of orbit as an explanation for floods caused by electromagnetic energy. So, I'm going to talk about this from a different direction. There is a thing called creation science. And creation science basically is the explicit counterpoint to evolutionary scientific theories. And so creation science is sort of the set of ideas that have created these creation museums where dinosaurs are with people and all the rest. Yeah. And clearly as anarchists and as people who more or less share a rational worldview, we reject creation science.
Yeah. I just on the radio the other day, they were talking, sometimes I listen to the Christian channels, they were talking about how they've found Egyptian chariot wheels on the floor of the Red Sea. And nice. So now there's proof of the fact that Pharaoh's army was buried
by the Red Sea. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, so, and as soon as you enter the world of creation science, you have to start talking about UFOs, and cold fusion, and basically like ideas that the scientific community considered to be wingnuttery, and we as beneficiaries of that scientific community have to nod our heads and agree, like, what you say is true. Chariot wheels on the Red Sea, that sounds crazy. So that's the preface from my perspective. The problem is we are anarchists, which means that we believe a very fringe political theory that sort of assumes things that regular liberal folk do not agree with, do not share in the value system of. So we have to be open to the idea that perhaps the scientific community is an ideological community, right? Let's use the same terminology that we would use to describe political movements. And I think that Vine Deloria was with us on this particular topic, and that they basically agreed with this idea that the scientific community, the community that defined natives in the ways that it did, the community that, used to think that the Earth was at the center of the universe and then one day changed their mind. I think that what Vine was trying to point to in his work was in general that the scientific community was ideological, and that there are some clear-thinking people who are basically called fringe scientists, who are called fringe thinkers, and this Velikovsky is one of them. I never read Vine as saying that he agreed with Velikovsky's ideas or with any of these alter scientific community people's ideas. I think what he was trying to say, and which I kind of agree with this project of saying, like, here's an example of a different way to think about this, about the same things that our current mythological system, which we call science, as described. So in other words, if science describes the world as one way, if you take the veil of scientific ideology from your eyes, you might see the same evidence as meaning something very, very different. And so that's at the heart of like my thought about whether or not Deloria was allied with Velikovsky. And the reason that I mentioned creation science is because, like, if you look on Wikipedia under Vine Deloria, and if you look around around Ultra Stories or on the Bering Strait myth, which Vine Deloria is one of his projects, really took on the idea that Native Americans walked from Asia to North America by way of the Bering Strait myth, and sort of some of the insanity that results from that that line of reasoning. That really what Deloria was doing was being introduced to different ideas about how to think about how the world has come to be that don't fall in line with the liberal, secular, scientific worldview that we currently use.
Yeah, and I think a big part of this that often gets overlooked is, so as you were saying, most anarchists have a more or less secular, rational worldview that might call itself scientific realist or scientific mm-hmm. materialist. And that worldview says the things that come out of scientific theories are either true or generally true or are approximating truth and getting better all the time, and this is an account of the real world. And that is basically a funny sort of North American middle-class worldview that says, mm-hmm. I read The Atlantic, and I read Mother Jones, and I read The New York Times, and I'm not like these religious middle American people who believe all this hoo-ha. And it's not necessarily the actual view of scientists. Many scientists are in line with this view and think that what they're doing is more or less getting at the truth, but many scientists are basically just engaging in this sort of repetitive factory labor. Like, they're just people who go in and hate their jobs and do repetitive stuff all day, and it's not fun for them. And then at the end, they get a bunch of data points that go to the higher-up scientists who actually interpret these things. Mm-hmm. But many of these higher-up scientists and people who have actually looked at the history of science and the philosophy of science, or who are philosophers of science, are not scientific realists. They don't say that, yeah, what the latest theories we have are saying is the truth. Many of them, like some of the biggest names in the history of the philosophy of science, like Karl Popper or Bas van Frassen, are saying science doesn't aim at the truth. Science is just, the scientific method is just a practical tool for engaging with our senses in a systematic way that lets us manipulate certain things and make have these technological achievements that give us more control over the world and allow us better to make predictions, but that it's not uncovering the ultimate nature of reality. And Karl Popper said, science is just conjecture. We're just putting out the best conjecture, and when we get more data, that conjecture will change.
Yeah, I mean, this conversation reminds me a little bit, and so when we talk about popular understandings of the world, it forces us into some very conservative sort of cul-de-sacs. And what I believe that Vine Deloria was interested in was breaking open scientific hegemonic thinking, and that meant talking to freaks. But I don't know that that's the case. I'm sort of speaking on someone's behalf who I don't know personally, and I guess perhaps what I'm saying is that that's my interest in what Vine was doing, and that perhaps we as anarchists have a really difficult project to do, because a lot of the understandings that we need of the world and all the rest require talking to people who are basically strange, who are weird, who are pariahs in their own space. And I think a little bit about C4SS. So this is totally appropriate within the context of talking about radical politics, although they're arguably not that radical of a project. But these are people who are pro-market. Center for Stateless Society at c4ss.org. And that basically, like, they are unacceptable in the general anarchist sense because they are they're pro-market. And so what does pro-market mean? Well, from my perspective, pro-market means that they want to have a conversation about an imaginary reality that we are never going to live in. And so I don't curse them, I don't damn them for wanting to having an interest in economics or in sort of sciences that I think are bullshit. Just like I don't damn anarcho-communists for also wanting to talk about economic systems that they're never going to experience in their life. And so for me, the conversations about markets are conversations that have ATR. But
where
I understand
they,
that
imagine some kind of fictional historical condition of the market that existed before the state.
Perhaps, again, these are conversations that hold no compelling interest for me, but I think it's totally okay for other people to have them. And this is a thing that you see in anarchist circles that I find to be really toxic, and one of the reasons why, sort of like, if I were to recreate anarchism from the ground up, there are some values I would not include, one of which is that if you link to C4SS, many anarchists will say, that's forbidden. Those are anarcho-capitalists.
They have the bad hats.
Right. And you cannot do that. That is forbidden. And basically, there will be no more conversation. I will personally stop any conversation that doesn't include excluding those people. And this sort of, I hate to say intolerant, but basically locked into a particular worldview that bars no disagreement. And to me, this is a core flaw in a lot of people's anarchist practice and a lot of people's anarchist thinking, and that some ideas are bad and therefore should not be explored. And this can very easily be extrapolated to a conversation about science. Science is good. Value systems that are the best for all, you know, motherfucking Spock shit.
I think I'm missing the reference. I mean, I know it's Star Trek, but I don't.
Spock has this quote as he's dying, where like the good of the many outweigh the good of the one.
Oh, so he's a utilitarian.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it's the rational world, absolutely. The rational ethical world.
So, I mean, so I guess this question.
Well, the question, I think, is how can you endorse this person who believes in this? And I don't think it's a super aggro-pointed question, but
No. How
can you endorse this person who believes in nonsense scientific theories?
Yeah, and I think that all of us have sat down with people who talk nonsense at us for an hour and walk away from the conversation valuing the conversation because they got something out of it, even if it was like, this is what a very skewed worldview looks like, skewed from my own. Okay, well, I think that's it for listener feedback. So let's in the remaining 15 minutes, talk about your project, talk about the society.
So this
again.
Is something I. I was having an interesting conversation with a mutual friend of ours and thought that it applied really well to the past episode we had talked about with society, and I was trying to put out this definition of society as being this tipping point at which you have enough people that you start to have anonymity and you start to have these socially imposed value systems, and so society exists as this certain set of reifications that force someone into adopting value systems that aren't their own and engaging in people as abstractions. And so this is Dunbar's number, which some people may have heard of, and it allows me to do one of my favorite things, which is deflate the human being back to what it actually is, which is just another organism on this planet. And it is a anthropological perspective that if you take seriously at all, it pretty much instantly deflates the grandiose aims of society. And what Dunbar's number is a supposedly hard limit to how many intimate relationships we're actually capable of having. And it might represent some kind of cognitive limit for the human being, and also a just time management limit. And so what Dunbar says is Dunbar's number is the number of people that you would not be embarrassed to sit down and have a drink with if you ran into them at a bar by accident.
Hmm.
And so the people with whom you have some kind of familiarity. Mm-hmm. And so he arrived at this number by looking at a correlation between the brain size of different primates and how many other monkeys they had in their social group. And so he extrapolated from that to the human brain size and arrived at a number of about 150. So that was the sort of speculative point. And since then, there's been all this evidence dug up about how many holiday cards people send out, how many friends that they actually actively engage with on social networks, how many, and then there are all these like weird historical ways that it came up where hunter-gatherer communities were right around 150, business organizations that functioned well were at 150, church sizes, army companies from ancient Rome to today, right around 150, Neolithic villages, academic research subdisciplines. People just tend to naturally end up at this point of 150 when you have a social group that's functioning well. I can tell you want to say something.
Well, I mean, you had me there in the very beginning. Like, I was willing to work with you.
The primate brain thing?
No, prior to that.
Prior to that.
The idea of talking about a number that's sort of conceptual in orientation,
mm-hmm.
I really like that idea. The idea that, I mean, the thing that,
You want it to be conjecture, you don't want it to be...
As soon as it tries to tie itself down to, then there was some evidence, you lost me entirely there because what you've defined is so touchy-feely, and all of your evidence, I guarantee if we go through every single example, it's all interpretation.
Sure, yeah.
But that's
saying that's not.
No, but interpretation and evidence are not the same thing. They're arguably opposite concepts.
They arguably are, but I don't take them that way. I think it's, as I was saying before, it's always
conjecture. So now we disagree.
We'll see, but what I'm saying is it's always the best conjecture. It's
okay,
so
well,
you
then,
go from then, a certain amount of evidence and say, this is what it seems like it is now.
So what's your point? Is okay. Your point that we should find 150 of our closest friends and move to the country with them?
So I think there are all kinds of fun implications here for anarchism. One is that it just makes the idea of mass society on the face of it ridiculous, because how could we have a...
But that's not the goal of mass society.
Mm-hmm.
Mass society is a control and conquer scheme.
Well, but the ideology of there can be a global village, we can all be connected to each other, that the idea that we can have political representation, these are the myths of mass society that say it works, look, mm-hmm. it works, we can have representation. And what this does is immediately deflate the political project, because when you have representatives that spend more time with one another than they do with the people that they represent, they are going to form their own Dunbar. They are going to start having intimate relationships with each other. It's going to be more important to pass the bill that your buddy wants to get passed, and you're saying it's not just that with power becomes some sort of corruption. It's not even the fact that the most sociopathic or detached people are going to be the ones seeking out the positions of power. What this says is that to the extent to which you take this seriously, you cannot take seriously the idea of political representation, even if you could somehow have the best possible people, the most compassionate and attentive people, and who sincerely devote themselves to this, because they are going to, whatever their aims, start treating the people they represent as just abstractions, as ideas of people. And there's no way that you can have the kind of intimacy and concern for others that you get from just the hard face-to-face physical interactions.
Okay. I'm not sure I needed Dunbar's number for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a matter of fact, an egoist position seems to articulate that in a more essential way.
Mm-hmm. what I was putting forth before in response to listener feedback. Yeah. Well, to me, this is just another way of interpreting it, and a way that does it in, I think, a different way. You're not saying these are principles that I...
Well, actually, let's talk about this from a different direction.
Okay, well, let me finish and say, it's just a way of addressing this in a biological, anthropological worldview. And so it's just a way, I think, that you have different perspectives dovetailing and arriving at the same conclusion. And that's what I think is interesting.
Yeah, and that's actually where I disagree.
Okay.
But I don't find that disagreement to be where what I want to dig into today.
Okay.
I think that... I want to talk about politics for a second. Most of us who are, you know, have decided that we are have a radical take on politics, or what that means is that we want to strip politics down and really understand what it is that it does and really interrogate that process. And so why I'm really hostile or why I'm surprisingly hostile to what it is that you're talking about is because you're conflating politics with science. And so for me, it feels like, I guess I'm, okay, I don't want to do that. Okay.
I think I know where you're going, and I have a response.
Well.
Go ahead.
Well, I actually disagree with this. Okay. When we talk about a concept like the functioning size of a social atmosphere is 150 people, it's a prefiguration and it's a prefiguration that doubles down on its prefiguration by saying that this is all attributed. Like, I have proof, I have evidence, evidentiary proof. What it misses, and why this stuff never fucking carries any water in the world that I live in, is because it's basically talking about attributes that are rhetorical attributes, not actual attributes. Like, I perhaps know that I can only, that my extended friendship group only looks like 150 people, but I have desires that are much greater than that. And therefore, the science of it is irrelevant. I'm still pursuing my desires.
Sure.
And so for me, this is a sort of cart and horse problem where we're talking about the fact that society is such that there are structural constraints, but I'm not going to be constrained by those structural constraints. And so now we have a sort of conceptual fight, and that's, I think, what we're having also.
So there's a great line that goes something like, a philosophy becomes toxic, or a philosophy fails when it starts to believe in itself too much. Mm-hmm. One way of talking about the Bellamy dream of these tiny permaculture communities is to say that my egoist position means that I want to dissolve myself into a union of egoists, and I want this from a deeply felt visceral principle. Mm-hmm. Another way of talking about it would be to say, we need economic justice, and the only way that that's going to happen is by having these small face-to-face communities, and so the morally correct thing for us to do is to live in these communities. Another way of saying this is to say, humans evolved as primates in a deeply enmeshed social group, and our brains have developed in this way, that the only way that we're going to be happy and actualize ourselves as organisms is by living in these groups. These are all arriving at the same conclusion, and they're looking at it from different perspectives. I think what is dangerous is to harden into any of those perspectives and say that this is absolutely the real, and we know it because of a universal human morality, or we know it because of biological, anthropological evidence, or we know it because of deeply felt intuitions. The way that I like to approach things is to provisionally adopt a number of different perspectives and say, I take a bit from this and believe in it to some extent, I take a bit from that and believe it to some extent, which I think is in line with what you talk about at the beginning of The Brilliant when you say we are we believe in sets of stories, not the one final and true story. And so what I'm trying to say is, what informs me and what excites me about something like Dunbar's Number is it's another way of looking at things that starts with certain assumptions and arrives at certain conclusions. And we can tentatively believe in each of these things, or believe in each of them a bit, or say that they're each a model.
Well, and so insofar as we're talking about how do we build models that perhaps are that guide our actions in the future, then I have no problem with this, and mm-hmm. and this is fine. But I definitely have a lot of problem with all the ideological apparatus that you're wrapping it in, which includes an anti-ideological component, as most ideologies have to nowadays.
But am I wrong in thinking that what you were being rankled by was this kind of technocratic perspective that says we've discovered the essential nature of the human organism and we now have a program to make that organism happy? The technocracy that believes in itself.
A version of this idea that I perhaps prefer, and perhaps it's because I read it first prior to this. I keep on wanting to say Avogadro's Number, but before reading about Dunbar's Number,
way too many.
In the book that I advocate for all the time, which is called Bolo Bolo, there is a very similar concept to this Dunbar's Number. But where it feels comfortable to me, this number 150 is very precise and very small. And so as an example, I'm not sure that I have 150 people in my life.
Now, no, I don't think I do either, but that's part of it, though. Yeah.
Well, but I know for a fact that at least twice that number listens to this podcast.
Right.
So that already sort of fucks with the... When you make a precise number like that, you're like, okay, well, what is that number? So, and again, I'm totally buying into perspectives I don't actually agree with for reasons that I feel like are obvious, but that I can go into more if we need to. So the number of people who want to listen to us talk is twice as large as the number of people who are in my life. But the truth is that my life looks a lot more like a household number of people are really in my life, right? 10 people live here. 10 people are very much in my daily life. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about is this gap between the people who are in your daily life, which looks like a household type number, and obviously we have a larger one than most. We don't just have a nuclear family's worth of people. We have more. So then there's this gap between the people who are in your life in this sort of generic sense of the word and the people who are in your life in the daily life. So this generic sense of who's in my life, well, there's the people with the long haul, there's people I see once a week at Berkeley Bowl, there's other people I see at the health gym that I go to, and so that number probably looks like 150. You know, that's fine. But of course, that number doesn't count at all the hundreds and hundreds of people who are absolutely in my life because of anarchism, right? Like, if I go to a book fair, there are easily 50 people who I nod to and I'm friendly towards. I don't even necessarily have a conversation with them because I'd never have a conversation with them, but I see them every X number of months. And that's hundreds and hundreds of people. So I say all that just to preface the fact that Bolo Bolo, this book I talk about all the time, very much articulates a future world, and its number, rather than 150, is 500.
Right.
And it's 500 because it counts the relationships of the people who I am talking about within the context of anarchism. So in other words, it basically says that your Bolo, and that number 500, why it's important, is because that's the sort of largest number of people you can have and not have an economic system.
Yeah.
And that there's something about that I really like, that has that feel of, like, it has a texture to it, whereas the Avogadro's, the Dunbar's Number, I'm not sure where the 150 ends, or, like, what you have to do if you, oh, shit, I'm at 150. Stop talking to me.
You split like an amoeba.
Right. But then all of a sudden, now you're back to 80.
Yeah. Yeah, he gets into it a bit. I would encourage anyone whose interest is piqued by this to spent a bit of time looking up...
Is there a book?
I don't know if there's a book. He
Is he alive?
A number of, yep, he's alive.
What's his name?
Robin Dunbar.
Okay.
Actually, the funny fucking thing about it, though, is he didn't even coin the term Dunbar's number. He put out this idea, and it got a lot of traction and went viral on social networks of all places.
So this is within the last 10 years.
Yeah, and then someone on Facebook, who knows who, just started calling it Dunbar's number, and then it caught on.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. But he does go into how there's these sort of tiers of intimacy, and I think there's room in there to have it dovetail with the Bulla Bulla number as well.
Well, I think that we should talk about other aspects of this in a future episode, because I don't think this is just about society. This is something about how do we model future visions.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I have been thinking at some point we would talk about prefiguration.
Sure.
And now I also, because of the charge that you delivered, now want to do an episode on ideology. So.
Yeah, that's too vague. But yeah. but for those of you who can't tell, Bellamy has taken his coffee cup into his hand and his laptop and is absolutely prepared to storm out of episode 14. Episode 16 of the Brilliant Podcast. Thank you very much for coming. Make sure to check us out at thebrilliant.org. Also, our email address is thebrilliant@thebrilliant.org. Is there any last things you want to say?
No, I think that's all.